Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. College sweethearts who fell deeply in love with each other, one from a less affluent background while the other lived a life of Texas luxury. As I look at the picture in which they're in a Harvard dorm room, hugging each other, smiles on their faces, I wonder if she knows how much he will steal from her, how this union will have an agonizing, deadly end. Okay, on to the show. Nancy Dillard was born on August 6, 1953, to William David Dillard Sr., aka Big Daddy, and Sue Dillard. Nancy was born after sister Susan and brother Bill, making them a trio until baby brother Tom was born. William, or Bill as he was called at work, was president and general sales manager of Auto Bar Systems of New York Incorporated, where he organized and managed their sales distributorship. He was offered a position in Dallas as the chief executive officer for the Great Southwest Commercial and Industrial Properties Incorporated. The family was excited to move back to Sue's hometown. They moved to the affluent Park Cities area of Dallas, comprised of two towns, Highland Park and University Park. They chose the Highland Park neighborhood as their home. Bill began to dabble in real estate and found he had a knack for real estate development. His wealth started to grow. His wealth eventually afforded Nancy and her three siblings access to some of the most prestigious schools in Dallas. In 1975, Nancy graduated from college and soon made her way to Harvard University's Graduate School of Design, where she studied landscaping and development. She would be partnered with a fellow student on a project. His name was Richard Lyon. Richard was from Connecticut and was of Lebanese and Caucasian descent. He came from a middle-class background. His father was an insurance salesman, while his mother was a teacher's aide. Richard was in awe of Nancy's drive and ambition. She carried herself confidently and knew she was incredibly talented. The project took 6 weeks to complete, and it allowed them to grow closer. Richard was enamored by her, but was understandably intimidated by her family's wealth. Despite his initial intimidation, Richard was welcomed by the Dillard family. He asked Nancy to marry him, and she said yes. They set a wedding date for February 1982. They graduated from Harvard and moved back to a duplex Nancy's father had bought for her in the University Park area of Dallas. She was thrilled to be able to do what she loved in her own home. Soon after they were married in 1982, Nancy was offered a managerial position with her father's longtime friend, Trammell Crowe. He had an established residential company in the Dallas area. In 1983, she made partner and was one of two women who were able to achieve that level of success in the company. Richard, who had been working odd jobs, had found employment with developer Kenneth Hughes. Richard would be responsible for overseeing large construction projects. Despite his limited experience, Kenneth hired him as a favor to Bill Dillard Sr. The couple welcomed daughter Allison in 1986. Their duplex was 1,100 square feet and gave them just enough room to house their little family. Despite the wealth and success they both achieved, they were not materialistic people. They spent a lot of time perfecting their backyard and creating a lush paradise for their small family. The happy family was complete when daughter Anna was born in 1989. Although born with a small hip problem, she was a relatively healthy and happy child. Despite the appearance of the perfect couple, Nancy and Richard's marriage began to weaken under the stress of the recession that hit the Dallas area, particularly its real estate market. The birth of Anna made their once perfect duplex feel cramped to the struggling family. Sure, Nancy was well off. She had her own money from her success at her job, as well as the occasional handout from her father. But Richard was uncomfortable with this arrangement. He knew he didn't fit in their family, and it bothered him that he didn't have the provider role that Bill Sr. had for his family. The Dillards were all pomp and circumstance, and that wasn't him. In fact, he recalls a time when the family was toasting to Nancy's success at making partner, and Bill Jr., Nancy's older brother, said she had married a Yankee and a yard man. Richard played it off, but he didn't appreciate the jab. They hired a full-time nanny for the girls. Her name was Lynn Pease Woods. The children affectionately called her Nanny. She would be witness to the deterioration of the Lyon marriage. It was late in September of 1989 when Bill Jr. entered a drug rehabilitation facility to combat his issues with cocaine and alcohol. The end of the program required a family therapy session to take place. It was late in September of 1989 when Bill Jr. entered a drug rehabilitation facility to combat his issues with cocaine and alcohol. The end of the program required a family therapy session. The session brought to light some painful memories for the Dillard family, specifically an incident of incest between Bill Jr. and Nancy. Nancy claimed that Bill Jr. had walked into her room and molested her. There was no intercourse, but Bill Sr. chalked it up to his children, playing doctor and nurse. Nancy was 13, and Bill Jr. was 15. The painful memories of this experience wrecked Nancy, and she stopped having sexual relations with her husband. Nanny Lynn recalled this is when she saw their marriage crack even further. Richard began traveling more and more for work. However, his work excursions included having extramarital affairs. He wasn't exactly trying to hide his philandering. He often bought lavish gifts or went on expensive vacations with these women. He met one woman at work, Tammy Ann Gaisford. He began taking frequent trips with her. Nancy was heartbroken over the betrayal, but she didn't make the decision to leave her marriage. Her family was understandably displeased with her compliance. She was beautiful and rich. It wouldn't be hard for her to find someone new who would treat her with the love and respect that she deserved. Yet, Nancy continued to fight for Richard. She would defend him and say,
"I know the real Richard, and this isn't like him. He's a family man. He's sick, but I know he'll come around."
Nancy's behavior was becoming quite erratic as Richard's affair with Tammy continued. She even dyed her hair a platinum blonde to match Tammy's. She was going to win her husband back. The changes Nancy made to her appearance seemed to work on Richard. He would return to Nancy in mid-1990 to reconcile and repair the relationship. However, in just a few short months, he would leave again. He cited her constant need to see a therapist as a reason for him leaving. He cleared their bank accounts and moved into his own apartment. He would still come over to the duplex from time to time and help Nancy out around the house. He noticed a fire ant mound in the backyard and tried to eradicate the infestation with strong chemicals purchased from a Dallas chemical company. One of those chemicals was arsenic. It was February of 1990, and despite continuing an occasional sexual relationship with her husband, Nancy retained divorce attorney Mary Heinrich. It's also during this time that Nancy began to fall ill on occasion. The occasions generally happened whenever she was around Richard. Tammy felt that Nancy was feigning illness just to get Richard's attention. Nancy and Richard reconciled for brief moments during the summer months of 1990, but it always ended. Nancy found a canceled check to a chemical company and called her sister Susan to see if Richard may be involved in drugs. Susan called the company and found that it was a chemical and plastics manufacturer. Nancy put it out of her mind and decided it was time to move on. Richard showed up one evening and invited her out to the movies with him. She was so happy to go on a date with her estranged husband. She settled into her seat and Richard returned with popcorn and Cokes. She took a sip of her Coke and immediately spit the beverage out. Richard, embarrassed by her reaction, asked what was wrong with her. She stated that it tasted foul and bitter. She removed the lid and saw a white, powdery substance floating at the top. She threw the cup away, but as the night progressed, she grew violently ill. He took her back to the duplex, and as she lay on the bathroom floor in between vomiting breaks, Richard was unaffected. Nancy's neighbor, Gail Golden, was privy to their spats and saw how Nancy was broken from the breakup of her marriage. She was thinner than usual, and her once bright and dewy complexion was now a pale alabaster with hollow eyes. She felt bad for Nancy and did what she could to help. The lavish backyard paradise that Nancy was once proud of, now became too much for her, and she let it go by the wayside. She recalls one moment where Nancy again grew ill on her porch. She handed her Anna, and then threw up. Gail called Nancy's parents, and they rushed her to the family doctor, who said she had just had a bad reaction to some antibiotics she took. 2 weeks later, she would have the same reaction. Nancy was finally done. She would write a letter to Richard that said,
"Not only are you free to go, but I need to demand that you go before even more damage is done to the children and to me."
In September of 1990, Richard finally pulled the trigger, figuratively. He petitioned the Dallas County Court for a divorce. In a way, Nancy was relieved. This marked the finality of her marriage to Richard Lyon, and now she could move on. She was even considering moving her and the girls to Washington, D.C. for a new start. Despite their separation and pending divorce, Richard continued stopping by to spend time with the girls. He made a nightcap for Nancy, and again she tasted a bitter substance and dumped the liquid. She saw the same white powdery substance in the sink. Nancy could no longer ignore what was happening to her, especially now that she was cramping and vomiting as she had the night of the movie date. It was after this meeting that the nanny witnessed Nancy change the beneficiary of her life insurance policy from Richard to her daughters. One night, Lynn brought a bottle of wine to Nancy. She said it was left on the porch and that there was an anonymous note. Nancy was confused by the gesture, and although she noticed the cork had been tampered with, she poured herself a glass of the Cabernet. She again became ill in the same manner as in the past. She recorked the bottle and stored it away. Richard, noticing Nancy was continuing to become ill, bought her vitamins. He implored her to take them so that she could start feeling better. Nancy met with her attorney to discuss how to proceed with the divorce and to discuss the division of assets. She shared with her attorney that she thought Richard had been poisoning her. She told her about the nightcap and the bottle of wine. Mary told her to bring the bottle of wine to her or to take it to the police. Nancy said she couldn't take it to the police. What if she was wrong? It would be so embarrassing to accuse her husband of trying to kill her. Mary understood her hesitation, but put a note in her files of the comments made by Nancy. In mid-October, Gail was shocked to see Richard had returned to the family home. Nancy had accepted his bid at another reconciliation. She wasn't going to make it so easy on Richard. She told him he had to prove that he wanted to be with her. It seemed like the early years of Nancy and Richard's life was coming back to fruition. They began working on the garden again, painting the house, and spending nights as a family, listening to Richard play his guitar. Oddly, Richard was still trying to combat the infestation of fire ants. He continued to order chemicals to treat the mound. Nancy was pleased to have her family back together despite her ongoing illness. She quit her job and became a full-time mom. Then, in January of 1991, her world came crashing down. First, on January 2nd, 1991. Then, after returning home from a trip to Connecticut to visit Richard's family, Nancy grew ill again. This time, she would not recover. On January 8th, 1991, Nancy was admitted to Presbyterian Hospital, complaining of violent stomach pains. Doctors were confused about what was causing her illness and said that it might be because of toxic shock syndrome. They tried to stop her vomiting but were unsuccessful in those attempts. She then was moved to ICU. Her parents and several family friends were on pins and needles in the waiting room, hoping their daughter, sister, and friend would recover. Richard was acting unaffected as usual. He was seen laughing and cajoling with the staff of nurses and doctors. He did not act like someone who was seeing their spouse in wretched pain, but then again, everyone handles these situations differently. Bill Sr. had pulled Nancy's doctor to the side and told him that he suspected Richard had poisoned his daughter. Dr. Ali Bagheri spoke with Nancy after Richard had returned home to shower and take the girls to school. It was then that she told him about all of the incidents where she fell ill in the past. She then begged him,
"Please help me. Help me. Don't let me die."
Several days would pass and Nancy fell into a coma. She would never wake up. She was removed from life support on January 14, 1991. She was 37 years old. Dr. Bagheri asked the family to bring the wine bottle, pills, and food from Nancy's residence. They were all tested, along with the tissue and hair samples from Nancy. On January 15, 1991, after an autopsy report concluded that Nancy had high levels of arsenic in her system, an investigation into her death was opened. Detective Donald Ortega was assigned to the case. He spoke to the Dillards and advised them not to let Richard on to the fact that he was a suspect. They did, and they did a great job. At Nancy's memorial service, Sue Dillard had her arms wrapped around Richard as they cried and sang Amazing Grace. Richard moved on with his life within a week of Nancy's funeral. Tammy had started coming around and even stayed overnight on occasion at the house. Meanwhile, investigators were piecing together the paper trail Richard had left behind. They found receipts for several of the chemicals that were used to poison Nancy Dillard Lyon. And I didn't mention this before, but when they concluded the autopsy, they found that she had over 100 times the acceptable level of arsenic in her system. Detective Ortega brought Richard in for questioning about the chemicals and his continued affair with Tammy. He initially denied buying any chemicals or the affair with Tammy and said he just knew her from work. Then, when provided with proof that he did buy the chemicals, Richard defended himself by saying it was to treat a fire ant problem. He also addresses his affair with Tammy by saying it was complicated. They question him further about his week-long vacation with Tammy after Nancy's death. He chalked it up with trying to move on with his life. The investigation concluded in May, and they finally had enough evidence to arrest Richard for the murder of Nancy Dillard Lyon. He posted the $50,000 bond and was released until his trial. The girls were temporarily placed with Bill Jr. On December 2, 1991, Richard's murder trial began. The prosecution, led by Chief Prosecutor Jerry Sims, alleged that Richard had systematically poisoned Nancy with arsenic and capsules he passed off as vitamins that were really filled with barium carbonate, a chemical found in rat poison. Prosecutor Sims said that the state would prove that Richard's excuse of trying to eradicate a fire ant infestation would be disproved and that he wanted to take his wife's money and have a new life with his mistress. The prosecution called several witnesses who could offer evidence that Richard had ordered these dangerous chemicals and could testify about his behavior on the day and weeks after Nancy's death. It was all very condemning. Richard's defense team was led by Dan C. Guthrie. He rebutted the prosecution's claims and said that Richard had no reason to kill Nancy. Richard was the one who had filed for the divorce and agreed to Nancy's terms in the divorce. He didn't have to kill Nancy to get out of his marriage. It was already happening. The defense argued that the police failed to investigate other potential suspects. For instance, Nancy's former boss, David Bagwell, was being sued by her former company. Nancy disliked him and was scheduled to testify against him. She received a threatening letter telling her to stay out of the Bagwell case. Nancy's father disputed this by saying that David was a close friend of Nancy's and had even visited her in the hospital. Bagwell denied any knowledge of the letter. Then, the defense claimed that Nancy may have intentionally poisoned herself because of the incestuous relationship between her and her brother Bill. They produced diary entries where Nancy said she feared that Bill would come for her again, or even worse, her daughters. They produced documents from the chemical company where the poison was purchased from and showed an invoice that Nancy had signed for. They even had a handwriting expert testify that the letters and signature on the slip were that of Nancy Dillard Lyon. Richard even took the stand in his own defense and passionately denied that he murdered his wife. He said that he would have never thrown his life away. He enjoyed it too much to risk it for something like this. Upon cross-examination, He was asked the following. At what point, Mr. Lyon, did you come down and tell the police department in University Park, the Dallas Police Department, the district attorney's office, at what point did you come in and tell us about these suspects and all these people that had all this reason to kill your wife?
At what time? There was...
Yes, sir.
There was no time.
At what point did you call us and tell us that Nancy had arsenic and she had ordered this stuff and that you had papers to prove it?
Ma'am, I was under arrest and indicted for murder. I mean, there was no conversation with your office or the police department at that time.
In their rebuttal, the state called Mr. Charles Couch, who was the owner of the Dallas Chemical Company, where the invoice supposedly came from. He stated that the invoice was bogus and was a contentious witness for both the prosecution and the defense. In their rebuttal, the state called Mr. Charles Couch, who was the owner of the Dallas Chemical Company, where the invoice supposedly came from. He stated that the invoice was bogus and was a contentious witness for both the prosecution and the defense. He was annoyed to have been subpoenaed in general, so he wasn't very compliant. He stated that someone came in asking for a formula to kill fire ants. However, he didn't sell arsenic in his facility. So the fact that someone signed an invoice saying that they were sold that chemical from his company was impossible. They then called an 18-year veteran of the FBI who specialized in handwriting analysis. The prosecution's handwriting analyst compared both Nancy and Richard's handwriting, while the defense analyst only looked at Nancy's. They concluded that the notes submitted as Nancy's diary were partially written by Nancy, but that the entry about Bill Jr. was written by Richard. The signatures on the invoice was also forged by Richard. The case was now with the jury. 3 hours later, they had their verdict. Not guilty was not their verdict. Richard was found guilty of the murder of Nancy Dillard Lyon on January 17th, 1992. On January 19th, he was sentenced to life in prison. Allison and Anna were sent to live with their Aunt Susan and her husband. They are now adults and possibly live in the Dallas area. Richard is housed in the Huntsville Prison in Huntsville, Texas. He was denied parole in 2016 and will be eligible for review in 2021, which will likely be denied due to the heinous and malicious way he chose to murder the mother of his children. The Dillard family continues to live and thrive in the Park Cities. Why do you think Nancy stayed despite knowing Richard was poisoning her? Do you think she was too naive? Or was she so deeply in love that she never thought it would go this far? Be sure to share your thoughts with me in the Facebook discussion group. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? I want to thank Jennifer S., a local to Dallas, and for giving me the case suggestion. I really appreciate it. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCPod, Facebook.com/TCFCPodcast, Instagram TCFC_podcast. Case suggestions can be sent to TCFCPod@gmail.com. Custom music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams. Check them out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Research assistance and content editing for this episode was provided by Brittany Martinez. Audio engineering was provided by Ches Gray Music. Thank you to Nina Instead, host of the Already Gone podcast, for voicing Nancy. And thank you to my husband, Brett, for voicing Richard. Now for some fun announcements. I will be in San Francisco in mid-September doing a crossover episode with the host of Misconduct, Colleen and Eileen. I can't wait for you to hear it. My episode will feature a Texas case, while theirs will feature a California case. Be sure to follow us on social media so you can find out when the episodes are due to air. Congratulations to our two winners of the autographed copy of The Bigamist, Meredith and Lana. The book club selection for this month is The Stranger Beside Me. Check in on the discussion by heading to our Facebook page and clicking on the group. You'll be asked to answer a question, and then you'll be added by one of our lovely mods. Just a reminder that my new show, We're All Just Pretending, has debuted. You can listen to the first episode on any podcast player of your choice. I can't wait to hear what you think. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out some of my pod friend shows.
Hello, true crime fans. I'd like to introduce you to a documentary-style podcast about real people pretending to be someone else. It's called Pretend Radio. It's about con artists, false prophets, and real people who are living a lie, like this man, who worked as an FBI undercover agent for 27 years.
So what I had to do was a cold approach, which is in undercover cases is the most difficult. So Mahmoud looks at me, but he's still glaring, and he barks some orders in Arabic. So I'm thinking to myself, did Mahmoud just tell him, you know, get the Uzis and pull the van up by the back door?
And we learn how one man went from being a small-time street thug to running a multi-million dollar medical scam.
He goes, you know the doctor went to jail, right? And I was like, the doctor went to jail? I was like, no, I didn't know that. Why would he go to jail? He said, yeah, man. I called my lawyer and I tell him, hey, man, look, I think I got a little problem. He says, what happened? I said, I talked to this guy. He said, the doctor went to jail. I'm pretty sure that if the doctor went to jail, they're going to probably be looking for me as well.
If you like what you heard, subscribe now to Pretend Radio. And follow us on Twitter, pretend_radio. Remember, fake it till you make it.
Imagine being accused of a horrible crime that you know you didn't commit. That's in episode one. Imagine your child's killer is still on the loose, but the authorities keep saying they don't suspect foul play. That's in episode four. Or imagine that you've spent 17 years in prison, only to then be fully exonerated due to advances in science. That's episode 10. My name is Jillian, and my podcast is Court Junkie, where I cover criminal trials and court cases and conduct interviews with those close to the case. Check out Court Junkie, available now everywhere you listen to podcasts.
The Fall Line Podcast is a true crime audio serial focusing on marginalized communities in Georgia. The first season investigates the March 18, 1990 disappearance of Augusta, Georgia twins Jeanette and Jeanette Millbrook. The twins, who were 15 at the time, were treated without cause as runaways, and their case was closed less than a week after their 17th birthday. Now, our podcast works to amplify the voices of the twins' family and to uncover facts, explore and dispel rumors, and develop theories in their case. Season 1.5, out this fall, will cover the case of missing Brunswick, Georgia siblings Monica and Michael Bennett, who disappeared in 1989. Join us as we work in real time to investigate their case.